Welcome, everyone, and thanks for joining us for this event hosted by the UCL Center on U.S. Politics, a retrospective on the 2020 U.S. elections. My name is Thomas Gift. I'm director of the center, and it's great to have all of you here. This evening, we'll be talking broadly about key takeaways from the recent U.S. election, what it all means, and how we should make sense of it. Before we start, I'll just note that this event is generously sponsored by the U.S. Embassy in London. This is also the second of four events that CUSP is hosting around the U.S. elections, which we hope you'll attend. Please visit our Twitter handle, @CUSP_UCL, or our website for more details. Right now, we are fortunate to have a terrific panel, and I mean that. I was so delighted when everyone here agreed to participate because they just offer such an incredible wealth of knowledge and insight into American politics, and I'm looking forward to seeing how they're interpreting this election aftermath. In terms of the format, I'll just start by doing some brief introductions, then I'll hand it over to each of the speakers for about 3 to 4 minutes to offer key reflections, and then we'll begin the audience Q&A. The Q&A feature should be open now for those of you in the audience, so we encourage you to ask questions. In no particular order of introductions, first we have Sunshine Hillegas, who is professor of political science at the best of places, Duke University, and an expert on U.S. public opinion, campaigns, and surveys. She's the author most recently of Making Young Voters, Cambridge University Press, which came out this year. Second, we have Ross Douthat, who is an opinion columnist for the New York Times and an absolute must-read every week. He's the author also this year of the book, The Decadent Society, How We Became the Victims of Our Own Success. Third, we're happy to welcome Terry Moe, who is the William Bennett Monroe Professor of Political Science at Stanford and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's also published a book this year, Presidents, Populism, and the Crisis of Democracy from the University of Chicago Press, which I have read and recommend highly. All these books coming out, I'm disappointed we can't have a book signing afterwards, but I'm sure they're all available on Amazon. And finally, we have Paul E. Peterson, who is the Henry Lee Shattuck Professor of Government at Harvard and also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and like all of our panelists here, his many books and accomplishments are too long to list. So with that, I think we'll get started. Perhaps Sunshine, I could turn it over to you first, then we'll hear from Ross, Terry, and Paul, and then open it up for Q&A to the audience.
Thank you so much for having me. And with only a few minutes to offer comments, I thought I would organize my thoughts around 3 points. The first on polls, did the pre-election polls miss the mark? And if so, why? I'm on the American Association of Public Opinion Research Task Force to answer this question. And here's what we know so far. There are a variety of different explanations for and hypotheses about why the polls have systematically underestimated Trump support, especially in states that Trump ultimately won. It does not appear to be about shy Trump voters. It's not that individuals seem to be lying about their support for Trump when they talk to a pollster. The more likely explanation that seems to be emerging from our analysis so far is that Trump supporters are being systematically less likely to be contacted or more likely to refuse participation. And this is something that, you know, we will be studying over the course of many years in the polling community. On the other hand, it's perhaps not that surprising given the challenges of polling today, and in particular, the challenges of using polling to make predictions. And to give just one example of that challenge, the scientific basis for polling comes from being able to draw a random sample from a population. But in the case of pre-election polling, we don't know the population because we don't know who's going to show up to vote. So pollsters have to guess, and they are looking at past elections to try and guess, but history is not a perfect predictor. And we have too few elections to be able to make an accurate guess as to that likely voter model. So that means that we're really just asking too much of pre-election polls often to give us this very precise prediction in a close race. And the basic fact of polling means that there's much more uncertainty in the predictions than what you get pollsters reporting on from the margin of error. And turnout is the second point I'd like to make. And that is that that turnout that had messed up the polls is also something that is, you know, incredibly unusual about this election cycle. We're seeing historic turnout levels. It's looking like when all votes are counted, we're going to exceed 65% of the American public voting. With record numbers for first-time voters, which is particularly difficult to capture in the context of polling. And it's especially striking because voting was so much more complex in a pandemic. And so I suspect that many faculty members can tell stories of students flying back to their home states to be able to cast votes because their absentee ballots didn't arrive in time. There were 300 different election lawsuits governing the who, when, where, how people could vote in this election cycle, creating an incredible amount of confusion and variability. And the final point is about that first time voters. And just thank you for the plug of my book, just so I can put it up again. First time voters were voting at historic records, but there is a long way to go for young voters. The early estimates are that young voters increased their turnout rates from about 45% in 2016 to about 55% this time around, but there remains a massive gap in turnout between old and young voters. And it is the case that the lopsided support for Biden by young voters, that a lot of people are saying this was decisive in states like Arizona and Wisconsin and Georgia. At the same time, the narrow margin of victory for Biden means that lots of groups can claim decisiveness. You know, Native Americans and Latinos in Arizona, African Americans in Georgia. I mean, you could say that left-handed voters in Wisconsin were responsible for Biden's win in Wisconsin. So there is still an age gap and still a long way to go. I'll stop my remarks there and thank you again for having me.
Thanks, Sunshine. If we could turn it over to Ross next.
Sure. Similarly, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate, I guess, everything that I say should be under the umbrella that Sunshine just opened, the umbrella of uncertainty, which is to say we are, you know, just a couple weeks out from the election. The exit poll data that we have right now is pretty mediocre. And you shouldn't give too much credence to any pundit summary of the lessons from the election yet, maybe especially since, as you may have noticed, the President of the United States has not even conceded. So with all of those caveats, here are some egregious generalizations. I think the, to a certain extent, the outcome of the election is, in fact, obviously what everybody expected. Joe Biden was supposed to win, and he did win, and he probably won ultimately by a margin a little bit closer to the original polls than it seemed to look on election night. So in that sense, what people expected to happen did take place, but obviously there was still a big polling miss. The election was closer than people thought. There, you know, landslide, blue wave, they didn't take the Senate. They still have a chance of taking the Senate in Georgia, but they certainly didn't win Senate races they expected to win. And the House is going to be more closely divided than people expected. So what you can take away from the provisional evidence is a few points. First, that there was a big gulf between how the Trump presidency was seen among, let's say, upper middle class, high information voters in big cities, including readers of my own newspaper, where it was seen as sort of a shambolic, catastrophic failure. And a lot of voters clearly didn't see it that way. Trump probably got more credit than people expected for the pre-COVID economy, for the strong US economy, probably got more credit maybe than people expected for the relative stability of US foreign policy in spite of sort of the internal chaos in the Trump White House. There was no equivalent of the Iraq War in Trump's first term, not even the equivalent of the rise of ISIS under Obama. No foreign policy crisis that sort of captured the imagination of American voters. And then Trump probably got less blame for the stumbling response to the coronavirus than a lot of people in the media expected too. There was more of a perception, I think, that this was sort of an act of God that any president would have struggled with, and less sort of particular blame attaching to Trump's fumbling and failures. So that's one reality. Another reality is racial depolarization in American politics is a real thing. You know, the narrative of Trump as sort of the candidate of white nationalism or white identity politics, notwithstanding, he won more African-American and Latino votes than he did last time, more probably than Mitt Romney won in 2012. A lot of the districts where House Republicans are doing well right now, especially in states like California, are places where they seem to get more Hispanic and Asian American voters. And so generally there's sort of a signifier here that the kind of idea that there's a kind of demographically inevitable Democratic supermajority coming to the United States took a blow in this election. And so did the idea, to pick up a little on Sunshine's points about turnout, so did the idea that if you just increase turnout across the board, Democrats will automatically benefit, because this was an incredibly high turnout US election, and it ended up very close to where the lower turnout 2016 election ended up. And so what all this implies, I think, is that gridlock and stalemate are more powerful forces in American politics than people really maybe in either political coalition are inclined to admit. You had this incredibly dramatic year of, you know, pandemic, riots, protests, temporary economic collapse, followed by economic stabilization. And in reality, very little of it may have moved the polls all that much. The Republican Party is not about to collapse in spite of Trump's own unpopularity. You know, we're still not quite a 50-50 country, but maybe a 51-48 country. And on the basis of 2020, likely to remain one for some time.
Great. Thanks so much, Ross. Hand it over to you, Terry.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Thomas. All right. I'm going to offer sort of a big picture perspective on this, pulling back from the details. I think this is one of the most important elections in all of American history. Because if Donald Trump had won another 4 years, I think he could well have brought American democracy down. So this election was very good for America in the sense that he was defeated. Joe Biden will normalize the presidency again. He'll reset our relationships with the rest of the world. He can do these things unilaterally. And now, all of this is hugely important. But, you know, on the other hand, this election was really a surprising victory for Republicans in many ways, in the House and in the Senate and the state legislatures. And one result of that is that Joe Biden's really not going to be able to pursue his policy agenda to the extent that it requires new legislation, and the big things obviously do. So his presidency is going to be very limited in that way. Now, the big question that a lot of people are asking is, what role is Trump going to play, you know, in the coming years? You know, that is an important question, but I think it's important to look beyond Trump and recognize three other factors that are at least as important. One is that even if Trump were to ride off into the sunset, his populist base would still be there. And these are people who are anti-system, who see the system as corrupt and illegitimate, and who support a strongman leader who can take on that system and get things done on his own, democracy be damned. Populism is a very powerful force in the United States and in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe, and it is, I think, inherently dangerous. All right, we can talk about that, but I think history bears that out, and scholarship bears that out. Secondly, the Republican Party has been transformed. It's no longer the party of Ronald Reagan. I think its transformation by Trumpism is one of the great tragedies of American politics in the modern era. The Republicans in Congress abandoned all principle over the last 4 years. They circled the wagons to protect Trump no matter what he did, no matter how much he undermined the rule of law, no matter how anti-democratic his behavior. They put partisanship above democracy. It was shameful, I think, and also very dangerous for our system, and they're going to continue behaving in that way. Also, Republicans are threatened by demographics. I disagree here with Ross because I think that the demographics are relentlessly moving against the Republicans. They are the white party. And yeah, they can pick off some minorities here and there, but I think at the end of the day, what we're going to find from this election is that 2/3 of Hispanics will have voted for the Democrats, and close to 90% of African Americans will have voted for the Democrats. And as this country becomes less and less white and more minority, the Republicans are more and more afraid of majority rule. And this it drives them, and it has driven them, to suppress the vote and to adopt all sorts of reforms, policies that are anti-democratic. And their strategy has been how to hang on to power without winning a majority of the votes. That is potentially explosive long-term. It's untenable and it's dangerous. And third, I think millions of Americans are siloed within the right-wing propaganda machine with Fox News at the center that spews out misinformation and wages war on the truth. This is a profound danger to democracy. No democracy can withstand that. And this is just going to continue. So bottom line, yes, Trump has lost, and I think this is a great thing. But dangers lie ahead for American democracy, and they're considerable.
Thank you, Terry. And last but not least, I'll turn this over to Paul.
Okay, so I'm going to see if I can share my screen here. Okay, voter turnout. I'm going to be a little bit of a skeptic on the voter turnout front because you can see how voter turnout has declined from its huge heights back in the late 19th century. But, you know, there was a big jump up in voter turnout for Obama back in 2008. And the turnout this time isn't, we don't know yet what it is. So there's a lot of uncertainty in all of this. But we don't, let me get my slideshow a little better up there. So that's the turnout picture. So Associated Press says it's about a half a percentage point higher than in 2008. You know, there's a voter estimate out there that suggests it's going to go higher than that. But given the fact that people had so many days to vote and so many ways to vote, I disagree with Sunshine that this was a particularly difficult election in which to vote. I think it was a particularly easy election, and yet people did not turn out to vote much more than in the past. So I don't really see this, oh, yes, it's true, it is all-time high, but we're a bigger country every election because we have more people living in this country every election. So that's the first point I'd like to sort of raise in as a controversy. And then it seems to me we are not a deeply divided country. Just because this election is close doesn't mean it's deeply divided. There's a lot of political science literature that says it's a big effort on the part of both sides to run to the middle of the political spectrum. And that happened again this time. Everybody supported entitlements. Everybody supported more money. Spend more, spend more, spend more. It was just Congress couldn't stop spending and the president signed off on everything. And nobody wanted to raise taxes. Biden doesn't want to raise taxes except on the 1% or maybe the 3%, but they don't vote in very big numbers. So, you know, the big issues, there was a lot of consistency on foreign policy. Nobody wants to go to war, and we didn't go to war. So there's a lot of consensus on the big issues out there. The Democrats run in the way that the opposition always run, on the weakness of the president. The president didn't stop COVID. It's hard to know how he could have. So no matter what he had done on COVID, he would have been attacked for that reason, and successfully so. It was decisive. But probably the campaign, apart from that one issue, didn't make too much difference. Because if we go to the bread and peace model, which is a model that says people vote on the basis of the economy, on the basis of whether at war or not, and you can pretty much predict what's going to happen, and it has predicted well in the past. Here's the 2012, 2016, Clinton got 54% by the model. She actually got 51% in the popular vote. And this time around, the peace, bread and peace model before COVID, not taking into account COVID, has Trump winning narrowly. And that's exactly where I think we would have come out, except for the fact he couldn't handle a big problem that everybody was concerned about. And the president's going to get blamed for anything that goes wrong. So voter turnout, bread and peace model. Finally, I think Biden is so lucky because he didn't win control of the Senate. He can now blame everything on the Senate. He doesn't have to appease the left wing of his party. He can just simply say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry those guys over there on the other side of the hill are not. And besides that, you got to worry about controlling the House of Representatives. And the Republicans, Mitch McConnell's got to be just delighted that he's got Biden for president instead of Trump, who he has always wondered whether or not this is a guy he could put up with for a single day longer. And now he doesn't have to. And he's in well poised to win the next election. It looks very risky for the Democratic Party in 2 years from now. Beyond that, I'm not going to predict, but this has got surprises all over the place. And the biggest surprise of all is that people were in the middle of the spectrum. They wanted a moderate. They want divided government. They love divided government. It's great to have divided government. You don't have to have any of these extremists running the country.
Okay, terrific. Well, thank you so much to all of our panelists for those comments. Again, I would invite audience members to enter your questions into the chat feature. I'll try to get to them as we proceed. I just want to start with one question for Sunshine. And that is, it seems like one of the defining characteristics of this election in the polls was, you know, a pretty steady and consistent lead by Biden dating back months, something that we didn't necessarily see in 2016. That was true despite the coronavirus, despite social unrest, despite huge swings in the economy in the preceding months up until November 3rd. What explains that kind of durability? And, you know, also at the same time, what explains, you know, this 40 to 44% of Americans who seem to be pretty much with Trump, irrespective of what happens, what he does, and anything that is occurring kind of in the broader political ecosystem?
That latter question is a more difficult one that we could all chew on for a bit. With respect to the polls, I think the issue is that in 2016, it was recognized that the polls were missing a lot of Republicans and particularly uneducated white voters in rural areas who voted for Trump. And so they started weighting their polls by education levels. And it's very clear that that just didn't do the job. And so, you know, so that the uneducated individuals who came that were willing to answer a poll looked very different in terms of their support, presidential support, than those who were not in the polls. So, I mean, there is this kind of fundamental issue of what's going on, that polls are missing this segment of society that is willing to show up to vote, because that's the big difference. Is it used to be the case that we knew that people who turned out to vote would be more likely to answer polls. This time around, you know, what we're increasingly seeing, and this is perhaps not a surprise given that we've had 4 years of Trump saying that polls are fake news. And so whether it is a matter of kind of deliberate exclusion from the opportunity to be polled, or a function of the methods being used, is still a little bit of an open question that we'll be studying. Unfortunately, one of the things that makes it so difficult for us to definitively answer the question is that a lot of the polling firms that are in the business of doing pre-election polls are what I call entrepreneurial pollsters. They are doing it for the sake of getting a headline. These are not necessarily well-regarded, well-respected, long-term, pollsters who are fundamentally invested in the survey industry generally. They are people who are coming out because they know that by doing a head-to-head horse race poll, they can get into the newspaper. And so, you know, at the end of the day, these are the type of pollsters who are not willing to share sufficient methodological information for us to actually be able to answer some of those key questions that I think impact the reputation of the industry overall.
Yeah, but Sunshine, I want to push on that a little bit. Is that, though the highly respected polls didn't seem to be coming up with a different answer than these fly-by-night polls?
And they will hopefully share the information that allows us to get at some of the hypotheses. So for instance, some of the pollsters were willing to share so that we could try and see, is it the shy Trump supporter? And so you can look to see, did you find differences in levels of support based on the mode of polling? So social desirability is higher when you have an interviewer on the phone saying, are you supporting Trump? But what the analysis has found so far is that even internet polling is not finding that, you know, difference in support for Trump, which suggests that it's fundamentally an issue of getting Trump supporters into the poll in the first place.
Sunshine, could I also ask a follow-up on that? And that is, you know, given the size of the lead for Biden in some of these states and going into the election, is there any evidence that that has a suppressive effect on voting? The people thought that this race was kind of over in certain states, and so as a result, they'd just decided not to show up. To what extent, you know, can we measure that, or to what extent do you think that may have been an issue?
I mean, certainly that's the argument that Trump is making. But you might remember that the argument was out there in 2016 that the reason that Clinton ultimately lost was in part because her supporters thought that she was already going to win, and so it wasn't necessary to show up. So I think there are legitimate concerns about how people use polling information, how that might impact their behavior, but there's inconsistent evidence about who that might ultimately impact. And certainly with respect to turnout, you tend to be talking about those people who have lower turnout propensity that might be influenced. And I think one of the big questions, and this is where in some ways I would push back on Paul a little bit with respect to turnout, is that there is wide variation in how easy it was to vote. In Massachusetts, in North Carolina, this time around, it was much easier because we had already fought all of the battles about access to the ballot in earlier election years. But you look at some of the states and you had to get a request for an absentee ballot notarized You had to, you know, some states, if you're doing mail-in, you have to pay for postage, and other times you don't. There is such variability. And while that doesn't affect those of us who are longstanding voters, because we've been in the same polling location, you know, since we re-registered many years ago, if you are something like 20% of the public that has moved over the course of the pandemic, that requirement to re-register and follow a particular set of rules for registration and voting in some places is easier or harder. And so, you know, yes, I think that a lot of states took measures to make voting easier, but I think that the turnout question is one that we have a lot more to study in terms of the variability and the extent to which the pandemic had an impact versus not. And in some ways, accusations of voter suppression may have actually created a backlash. So in places like Georgia and Texas, people went to extraordinary measures because they heard that their vote might be suppressed to overcome the cost of voting. But in states like Oklahoma and Alabama, you know, the pandemic had a real effect, and that's gonna show up in our national turnout numbers.
Great, thanks, Sunshine. Next question I want to toss to Ross, and this is kind of an encapsulation of a number of different questions that are coming up into the chat, and that is kind of what is the role of Trumpism within the Republican Party? How is the Republican Party going to evolve post-2020 in a way that maybe includes some elements of Trumpism, maybe not? How do you see this kind of going forward for the GOP?
So I think it's helpful to recognize that there are, like, you know, 12 different varieties of Trumpism. And I mean, I'll just talk about a few, right? So one form of Trumpism is a policy shift, a sort of populist policy shift within the Republican Party that mirrors some similar shifts that have taken place in Europe, and not only Europe, but other countries around the world, that basically would push the Republican Party in a somewhat less libertarian direction on economic policy, towards greater skepticism of free trade and mass immigration, and towards a little more support for policies like, you know, economic redistribution towards middle class and working class families, right, who are increasingly a crucial Republican constituency. That kind of Trumpism you can imagine being embodied by a bunch of different figures. You can throw in things like, you know, hostility towards Silicon Valley and big tech, a sort of newfound skepticism of monopoly power on the right. Again, all of these you could imagine being taken up and embodied by various ambitious Republican politicians, a Senator Marco Rubio, a Senator Josh Hawley. There are various figures within the Republican Party who have sort of imagined sort of taking the party in a populist direction on policy after Trump. Now, that's different from, though it overlaps with, Trumpism as a kind of authoritarian performance of the kind that, you know, Terry was talking about. Trumpism as, you know, a vision of the Republican Party as a kind of custodian of a besieged real America that's, you know, beset by enemies, foreign and domestic. Trumpism as just sort of a, you know, an attempt to kind of consolidate power around a counter-majoritarian rump. And that's, you know, in a way, the kind of Trumpism that you see showing up in Trump's own post-election arguments about voter fraud, where, you know, it's always these Democratic cities, these sinister Democratic cities and sinister Democratic elites, you know, who are messing with voting totals and denying him the majority that he rightfully won. So that's another form of Trumpism. But then finally, and I know I promised 12, finally, there's a form of Trumpism that's about sort of reality television performance, virtual reality, sort of living a kind of fantasy politics, right? And some of his post-election voter fraud stuff has that form, that it's not so much that Trump's about to lead some kind of authoritarian coup, it's that he's constructing an internet-based narrative that's similar to the internet-based narratives of QAnon and other things that are sort of powerful in the online right, that isn't really about politics per se at all. It's not necessarily about wielding power. It's creating online storylines that people can live inside and sort of bending political competition to fit these narratives. And I sort of tend to think, you know, and I think Terry and I disagree about a bit about this, that, you know, the third is actually more important to understanding Trumpism than the second. I would like personally for the first form of Trumpism to be the form that lasts. I think there are actually potential policy innovations contained within populism that I'd like to see in the Republican Party and going forward. But I think it's most likely that this idea of sort of politics as a kind of theater, you know, where you're theatrically owning the libs, as we say, and that's the most important part of what conservatism is. That's what I see as, in many ways, the most appealing part of Trumpism for a lot of people. And, you know, on the authoritarian point, like, you know, if you look at the coronavirus, right, like a lot of liberals spent the Trump era warning that if you had a crisis come along, it would be this sort of Reichstag fire moment where Trump would sort of consolidate power in this kind of fascist Hitlerian way and put paid to American democracy. But when an actual crisis came along, instead of seizing more power, Trump just wanted to live in a fantasy world, right, where the virus was going away any day now. It was going to be like magic, like a miracle. It will just go away. And, you know, the stock market can stay high and all of these things. And I think there's not just on the right, but a sort of powerful aspect of American politics right now where people want to live inside fantasies. So maybe they want a strong man, but it's not a 1930s style power consolidating strong man. It's someone who constructs, you know, sort of Disneylands of the political imagination in a way. And that could be Trump's most powerful legacy. We'll see.
Thanks. Could I also get Terry in on this question? I mean, I know that you've written a lot about Trump being more a symptom than a cause of some of the challenges facing US democracy. You know, how do some of these underlying structural forces, you know, affect how the Republican Party is going to evolve going forward?
Well, I think that the world has been shaped by globalization, technological change, and population movements, immigration, that have created serious disruptions in societies around the world, but especially in developed nations, which found their jobs being exported to less developed nations and people undergoing serious financial insecurity and having their cultures threatened by immigration, greater diversity. And that is it. Those are the forces that have fed this populist anger over the last 10 years or so. It's been growing for longer than that, but it really got virulent over the last 10 years or so. And it is an angry reaction against systems, political systems that in their view didn't respond to their concerns. And so I think that populism is very similar across these countries, and it does involve an anti-system yearning for a strong man to come along and attack the system and to get things done on behalf of the people, the real people of the nation, which in the United States is white conservative Christians, to do it in ways that simply circumvent the cumbersome procedures of democracy. And so really an anti-system movement within a democratic system is ultimately anti-democratic. And that's what's happened here. And so that I think, you know, there are policy shifts that are involved in Trumpism. But if you, aside from the coalitional policies that he adopted in order to appease Mitch McConnell and the orthodox Republicans, he needs them, right? So yeah, he'll do tax cuts and he'll go after Obamacare and he'll appoint conservative judges. He didn't care about those things, you know. He needed to do those things, but on his populist issues, he imposes tariffs even on our friends. This is less a policy shift than it is strongman behavior. He can do this unilaterally, and he did. What did he do to redistribute to his people? You know, did he adopt new healthcare policies for these people? No. Did he do anything about Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid? No, right? So really, he spent 4 years being the strong man. And in the meantime, making racist appeals, demonizing foreigners and immigrants, and basically stirring up anger and division in our society. That was the essence of his leadership. And when it came to democratic procedures and norms, he trashed them, he ignored them, and he behaved as an authoritarian in office. He obstructed justice. He actually committed crimes in office, you know, and got himself impeached, you know? So I think that populism is much more dangerous than many people realize. This isn't just about taking care of people who've lost their jobs and the hollowing out of manufacturing and the decimation of communities and so on. I think there are plenty of grievances that are totally legitimate among this populist base. But this is a base that is ultimately anti-system, angry, seeking a strong man, and willing to support anti-democratic actions. And Trump has risen to power by appealing to that base and by stirring it up, by firing it up, and by behaving as a strong man in office, right? And it's not just Trump. Look around the world at Hugo Chavez and Orban in Hungary, and on and on and on. And there's a playbook. These people are basically governing and appealing to their base in the same ways, right? So, you know, this isn't just about Trump. This is really about populism and the rise of populism and the dangers of populism.
So I want to bring in Paul in just a minute. I do have another question here from the audience, which is picking up on one disagreement between Terry and Ross. Trump surprisingly improved performance with African-American and Latino voters seems to cast doubt on the thesis that demographic trends in the U.S. all but guarantee an era of democratic rule in the coming decades. Is this election really a refutation of that thesis, an aberration, or something else?
You know, I thought maybe this was going to be a transformative election, but I don't think it was. I think it's basically a stand pat election, a continuation of the divided government that we have had for since basically the Reagan years, or we have had a half century of divided government almost all the time, with a few exceptions. And the public likes it that way. And what I find interesting is the position that Biden took during the campaign. He hardly talked about immigration. He basically conceded to Trump that issue. He barely talked about, in fact, they pretty much agree on trade policy. I mean, the Democrats have for a long time been pointing out that the working man suffers from this competition from abroad. Clinton took that same position. I mean, think of how similar the positions of the candidates were on so many issues. This idea that Trump was some alien force, you know, from far out in space. Well, sometimes he talked that way, and you can be easily distracted by his language. But I think, as Ross pointed out, when it came right down to it, when he had to deal with a real problem like COVID, he basically said, you know, let's leave it to local government to handle. Let's let the states and the governors handle it. It's hands off on my part, which probably he had to do, because if he had tried to impose an authoritarian system on society, as many people are urging be done, he would have been attacked for all of these villainous things that Terry mentions. Here he was, forcing us all to wear masks. No, he didn't do that. He did the opposite thing. But that didn't prevent him from being criticized, because a president gets criticized no matter what they do. So what's really interesting here is how both parties play the game. Go to the middle, attack your enemy on their greatest weakness, and hope for the best. And that's going to produce a very close election, which is what we saw.
So I would love to jump in on this point about support, you know, increased support among Latinos and African Americans. And I do think that this is going to be one of those elections where the election day narrative is perhaps one that doesn't necessarily match up to when we finally get the final numbers in and do the analysis. Now, that said, right, I think there are some important lessons to be learned about heterogeneity, the variation in the Latino coalition, you know, the Latino as a group. And we have the saying, demography is not destiny. And, you know, that at the end of the day, what I care about in terms of predicting somebody's vote is not, you know, their race, their gender. It is things like party identification. And I think we're going to ultimately see that over the course of the last 4 years, you know, Republicans are not all these base supporters who are racist white supremacists who, you know, are showing up at these rallies. That there is a large degree of variability in the Republican Party that have rationalized their support for Trump, you know, by saying things like, I don't like his tweets any more than anybody else, but I'm going to look towards the things that I do like. And so, you know, I just think that we have to remember how much variation there is in the public. And this goes back to a point that Paul made, you know, very early on. And that is, you know, it is a mistake to look at the degree of divisiveness and polarization in media coverage in the campaign and attribute that to the electorate. So there's a whole bunch of people who voted for Trump that, you know, are decent, reasonable people in a lot of ways and are not the caricature that we have come to associate with his base supporters.
Can I jump in here and just say something?
Of course, Sarah.
I think the electorate is deeply divided. You know, if you just look at where Republicans and Democrats stand on something simple like wearing a mask, for God's sake, right? The science is very clear on that. Republicans are anti-science. They do not believe in climate change. There are huge differences between Republicans and Democrats on climate change. Many Republicans, I think most Republicans, don't even believe in evolution. When it comes to race, Republicans are much, much, much more likely to think that the real problem is that whites are discriminated against, not blacks. Democrats see it the opposite way. On religion, white Christian conservatives think that they are the ones who are being discriminated against, not other religions. On trade, right? Suddenly Republicans are all in favor of tariffs. Gee, I wonder why, right? But there's a big difference between them and the Democrats on that. On Russia, big differences between the Republicans and the Democrats. On whether Trump should concede the election, on whether there's been election fraud. You know, you can just go right down the list. There are big differences. So I think, you know, people who look at certain public policy issues and say, well, yeah, the American public is pretty moderate on these. The big picture is one of these deep divisions on issues that really, really matter in our society. And I think that's a big reason why turnout was high in this election. Enthusiasm was so high because the stakes were so high as far as people were concerned. Also, any notion that Trump sort of went to the middle and played to the center, I don't get that. You know, Trump is an extremist.
Can we get Ross to jump in here?
Yeah, just a couple of quick thoughts. I mean, I think we could sort of actually partially reconcile Paul and Terry's arguments by saying that it is both true that we have stronger than in the past polarization between the two parties. There really are much bigger differences between core Republican voters and core Democratic voters than there would have been even in the Bill Clinton era, let alone 40 years before that. But also that there's a big chunk of America that isn't all that polarized. And so if you look at, like, if you poll people and say, you know, what's your view about whether masks work, and masks become you know, after the experts said masks didn't work, then they said they did work. So it becomes sort of a totem of like, you know, expert technocracy. And so Republicans become more hostile to it. You can do those polls. But then if you look at actual like mask use in Republican states versus Democratic states, you don't actually see huge differences. Like, you know, and some of those differences are just explained by the fact that Democratic states tended to have higher rates of disease earlier in the pandemic, and Republican states tend to be more rural. And so you have less, you know, fewer people crowded close together. So you don't, so you both have sort of a core of the Republican base that has, you know, very right-wing views, but also a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump, to Sunshine's point, who are wearing masks, right? And going to the grocery store and wearing masks and favor wearing masks and are, you know, within the same ballpark as a lot of swing voters who voted for Biden. So that, I think those two realities can coexist. Polarization at the edges of the parties. The other point I'd make is that we're, you know, as always in these conversations, we're talking a ton about Trump and Trumpism and Republican voters, because from a media perspective, those are more exotic creatures to some extent. But the reality is that politics is a dynamic process where both parties react to each other, right? So one reason that demographics have not doomed the Republican Party is that changing demographics have changed the Democratic Party. So if the Democratic Party was running on the agenda it had 20 years ago, it might be a supermajority coalition. But as the United States changed and moved somewhat to the left, you've had more pressure from activists within the Democratic Party to move the Democratic Party itself further to the left, something that you saw play out very strongly in, you know, debates about policing and race and crime over the summer. And out of that shift, you then get a Democratic Party that seems more extreme to some voters on the right of center, including African-American and Hispanic voters who have conservative views on some issues. And so they swing more towards the Republican Party. And so there's a sense in which you can have these deep demographic shifts that really do affect American politics. American politics is to the left of where it was 20 years ago. And to Terry's question, what has Donald Trump done to moderate? Donald Trump totally discarded everything that Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan were saying about entitlements 8 years ago. All the talk about sweeping reforms to Medicare, all of these sort of conservative think tank ideas were just gone. That was a huge move to the center that helped Trump win election and almost helped him win re-election. So those shifts take place, but the coalitions then adapt to them in ways that have maintained this, you know, if you either this sort of happy divided government in Paul's narrative or this, you know, debilitating gridlock in other narratives.
So Ross, I support that idea that there has been a shift, and Trump contributed to it. And on foreign policy, his very strong position that he's not going to get involved in war. And he's even talking about that after the election. He's going to withdraw troops from the Middle East. He just knows the bread and peace model. He believes in the bread and peace model. He says, you know, no war, and I'm going to put the economy first. I'm going to put the economy ahead of COVID, because if I can just keep this economy going, you know, that's going to be the issue. And so he is, to me, the personification of the Anthony Downsian president, who always wants to be in the middle and capture the median voter. If you look at his policies, he's almost the perfect example of it, but he combines that with this hysterical rhetoric, which I don't know how the two get matched together, except maybe the hysterical rhetoric satisfies his core constituency that Terry's referring to. And maybe, you know, so I feel like Biden's gonna have the same problem. He's gonna have the same problem. He's gotta satisfy that constituency. But he's really well poised to satisfy that constituency as long as he's got a Republican Senate.
I would add that there is incentive by the fragmented media environment to focus on the divisions, right? And to focus on the hysterics at the expense of talking about the things where there is actually common agreement, whether that is by the candidates or by the And so when we think about how can both of these perspectives, you know, be true, part of what is going on is and it goes back to Terry's point about the bubbles that we live in. And I think we should not underestimate the importance of Fox News calling Arizona on election night in terms of the potential pathway for some of the discussions that Trump, you know, some of his message about the election being stolen. And Fox News calling Arizona before any of the other networks, things that happened potentially, you know, in the election.
Can I just add one other thing? I think this idea that Trump has somehow gone to the center is just mind-blowingly wrong. I don't understand how anybody could say that. You know, like on entitlements. Paul Ryan and the others wanted to take extreme action on entitlements. The reason Trump hasn't done that is he doesn't care about that. What has he done? Nothing, right? His main approach is to disrupt, right? And so if you look at foreign policy, what has he done in foreign policy? He's disrupted everything, right? He's undermined NATO. He's imposed tariffs on our friends, right? He's dropped out of the World Health Organization. You know, he's basically on a path to destroy the international institutions that have been set up after World War II that have guaranteed peace and prosperity all this time. And what has he replaced it with? He has no vision about what this thing should look like. He has no alternative institutional arrangement in mind. The idea that is going to the center, again, is just like mind-boggling. I don't get it. You know, and domestically, the guy makes racist appeals. He demonizes immigrants. He does all sorts of things that are not centrist at all. The guy is on the fringes.
I'm gonna get Ross in here for a second.
Just very quickly, I was just gonna say, one, I agree with Terry. And again, I think there's agreement here that a lot of Trump's rhetoric is not centrist. It's pitched to his base and to even just a particular part of his base. And one of the interesting things is that Trump's race stuff is not at all popular. Right. There is this sort of idea that, oh, you know, this was Trump's dark magic, that he was making these racist appeals and building this, you know, white coalition. And you could argue that was true maybe in his initial primary campaign in 2016, where being a birther conspiracist did win him some, you know, some segment of the Republican base. But generally, Trump's polling on race relations is terrible. His worst polls over the summer were during the George Floyd protest when it was. So there isn't some like, you know, that's not something he does that's popular. And I agree, it is extremist in certain ways. I would just suggest that policy indifference and not, you know, not caring enough to do things on policy is itself a form of centrism. If you have a bunch of ideological people in your party who say, let's do these six things to change Social Security and Medicare, and you say, let's just do nothing, keep interest rates low and cut taxes, you're closer to the center than they are. There's a center of, you know, there's a do nothing centrism that is actually centrism, I think.
That's going to stay with us. I mean, I think that looking forward, we're going to see a president who's going to be on a similar set of pressures, but from the opposite direction. The climate change is a good example. I don't think the American public is excited about taking strong measures to prevent climate change. The costs are going to be too high to the American economy. So for a long time, it's been important to say that you want to deal with the serious problem of climate change without really doing anything about it. And I think Biden is going to be under greater pressure than ever before from the progressive wing of his party to do something about climate change. But if he takes strong actions to deal with climate change, he's going to upset his coalition. He's going to give away his political standing to the Republican Party, and the moderate voters are going to go in the other direction. So he's got to fudge that question. He's got to be rhetorically as overwhelmingly in favor of doing something about climate change as some of the things that Trump has been saying. He won't say it in the same hysterical way. He's too good a politician. I think you have to keep in mind always that Biden is a professional politician, and Trump is a ridiculous amateur. So, you know, when you've got a very experienced politician who's been in government for a very long period of time, they are able to handle these tensions between the extremes of your party and your need to govern and your need to move to the center. And I think Biden's going to try very hard to do that. I think he's in a very fortunate place because he's got a Republican Senate that he can blame everything onto as to why he's not going further to the left. On the other hand, he's got to worry about the fact that the Republican Party has not gone away. This is not an election where the Republicans feel defeated. They actually feel like they're in a stronger position than they were 2 years ago. 2 years ago, they were really crushed in the off-year elections. But they have made a major comeback, and they're big-time players, and they're well-poised to recapture power just as they did in 1994 when Bill Clinton had his first 2 years. And Biden's got to avoid making the mistakes that Bill Clinton made in his first 2 years if he's going to prevent the Republicans from really consolidating their control on Capitol Hill.
Can we shift gears a little bit and talk about the Democratic Party? Sunshine, one of the things that we certainly saw, I think, this election was an underperformance by the Democrats in the House relative to what they were expected to achieve. There was a big profile in the Washington Post a few days ago about these real significant infights between the moderates and the progressives within the Democratic Party, and how, you know, the moderates were essentially saying that Democrats didn't do very well this year because they were too easily labeled socialist by Donald Trump. Is there any merit to that? Like, how do you think that some of these, you know, battles within the Democratic Party are going to get resolved as we move forward?
So, you know, like, I think that some of these are things that we're going to be studying for a very long time. And once we have better data to actually take a look at them. But I think there are reasons to think a couple different things. One, that the focus on, you know, the message of defunding police is one that got used very effectively against Democrats, that Biden's lead in the polls was something that very effectively was perhaps used against Democrats, that the label of socialism was one that got used fairly effectively against Democrats. That some of the infighting in the Democratic Party that, you know, you expected if they were to emerge, as Paul referenced earlier, you know, if they were to emerge actually in control of government, then we would have seen these deep divides within the Democratic Party. But some of that was previewed during the campaign, in part because of, you know, the fact that you had the you know, Biden as the top of the ticket, and how there was this both message and ideological disconnect in so much of the conversation on the ground. And so, you know, like it is one of those things that I think whether it had an impact on any one House of Representatives race, you know, we can't answer that just yet. But I think certainly there is a narrative that is emerging about this tension within the Democratic Party that has, you know, the potential to chase off some voters. And frankly, I actually think that is very well could be part of the story among Trump's success among Latinos and African Americans is that, you know, that there are a lot of people who are just kind of tired of the racialization of all dialogue all of the time in the US. And I think that very much includes, you know, some segment of minority voters. I think it's premature to say that we have enough data to reach any definitive conclusions, but You know, I think these are the things that we will be studying.
Ross, do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it is, you know, it's a version of the point I was making before, right? That, you know, the country, the United States, has moved substantially left on issues related, sort of what get called social issues, cultural issues, issues related to race compared to 10 or 15 years ago. You know, in the 2008 election, Barack Obama was opposed to same-sex marriage officially, right? And, you know, now we've reached a point where that is no longer a live issue, and issues around transgender rights are sort of, you know, effectively an orthodoxy on the progressive side. And similarly on race, there's big shifts in polling on questions about, you know, how real is discrimination, how many disadvantages do African Americans face, and so on. But then out of that leftward shift, then you get a situation where the Democratic Party's left wing feels itself to be, you know, to sort of have all kinds of room to maneuver, and maybe exaggerates how much room it has to maneuver before it starts alienating, you know, even minority voters, or in some cases, especially minority voters. I mean, you want to hesitate. The phenomenon of a white pundit discussing the minority vote is going to be, like, you know, a very common phenomenon in these debates. So I want to, you know, I want to have that hedge. But there were, you know, long before this election result happened, there were really interesting polls showing that white American liberals were now to the left of Black Americans generally on some racial questions. Like, white American liberals were more likely to, you know, sort of emphasize, you know, America as a racist country and sort of issues of discrimination than minorities themselves. And I think you saw some of that play out in ways that probably cost the Democratic Party, and just created, you know, were sort of suggestive of this tension that the Democrats have maybe more than the Republicans, which is kind of a high-low class tension. The Democratic Party is the party of the affluent upper class and the intelligentsia, and still the party of a lot of working class Americans who are in many cases minorities and immigrants. And, you know, there's just a big cultural gulf between those groups that a really effective politician like Barack Obama can bridge, but it's hard, it's not an easy job to sort of keep that coalition in place without losing people at one end or the other, I think.
Ross, I wonder if there's some possibility that the Hispanic Latino vote will go in one direction and the Black vote, the Black African American vote, in another direction. I mean, there's a lot of heterogeneity within the Hispanic community. I mean, there's the Cuban community, there's the Puerto Rican community, there's the Mexican community, there's the Brazilian community, there's people from Venezuela, the people from the middle on the isthmus. So there's just so much variety. And some are Catholics, some are evangelical Protestants. A significant share are Jehovah's Witnesses, and then there are the secularists. I mean, it's like the Germans of the 19th century. The Germans of the 19th century could never have much political power because they were split on religious lines, and they were split on political lines, and they were split on economic lines. It was a very diverse migration to the United States, and I think we have overinterpreted the homogeneity of the Latino community. And if we start really understanding the Latino community and all of its complexity, we will stop referring to it in these abstract terms that have been part of the lingo for the last decade or more.
I think that's right, but I would stress that there is, you know, not comparable, but there is a lot of heterogeneity in the African American community too. Some driven by immigration, some of it driven by intermarriage. And I'll steal a point that Nate Cohn, who is our big sort of polling numbers guy at the New York Times, made to me a few days ago, which is that if you're in a position, as the Democrats are with African Americans, where you're winning 90% of an ethnic group's vote, and that ethnic group is sorry, heterogeneous. The danger is that any issue that comes along actually has the potential to weaken your hold on that group. So even if you get, you know, an issue comes along like Black Lives Matter protests and policing, and let's say 80% of African Americans are on the left wing side of that issue. Well, that 80% is still less than the 90% of their vote that you're getting. And so that issue suddenly has the potential to actually hurt you with that vote. So that's just one further wrinkle. I agree with everything you said about the diversity of the Hispanic migration, but even among African Americans, it's pretty easy to see how Democrats could lose 5% here, 5% there, you know, again, depending on what happens post-Trump with the Republicans.
Can I add to this? I think that there's a tendency on the part of Republicans, especially, I think, to try to have an optimistic view about what demographic change is going to mean for the Republican Party in the future. I think what it means is trouble. You know, the fact is Hispanics vote 2-1 Democrat, and they did again, you know, in this election. All the evidence that I've seen is that they voted 2-1. The Cubans are outliers, right? But basically they did what they've always done. And African-Americans are still voting almost 90% Democrat. And why wouldn't they? The Republican Party is a white identity party now. It's a party of white backlash. And going forward, what they've tried to do is to suppress the minority vote. How do you think the minority community feels about that? These are very purposive efforts on the part of the Republican Party to suppress the minority vote in a variety of different ways. They are anti-democratic efforts aimed at minorities. And there's a reason for that, because minorities are not going to vote for Republicans in big numbers. And so it is possible that if the Republican Party suddenly started adopting different kinds of policies that were appealing to African Americans and Hispanics, like, gee whiz, maybe they want health care. Imagine that. Or maybe they want child care, or maybe they want more job training, or all these things that Democrats are well known for offering, but that Republicans are not. Right? Republicans basically are not in the business of solving the social problems of people in these communities. So I think there are structural reasons why minorities don't vote for Republicans. And I think going forward, Republicans are very unlikely to attract them. And what they're going to be doing is investing more heavily in anti-democratic strategies.
Okay, I'm trying to get to as many Q&A questions from the audience. Here's one, and that is, what should we make of the sweeping defeat of the affirmative action Proposition 6 in progressive California during a year of racial reckoning? Meanwhile, Florida voters came out strongly for a $15 minimum wage. These are interesting and countervailing positions within the electorate relative to how those states voted. Can we learn something about the electorate based on these divisions?
On the first point, I just looked up the data on affirmative action and quotas over time, dating back to the 1980s. And when this was, you know, the Bakke case first came up, and it hasn't changed a bit. It's been 2-1 nationwide against affirmative action that involves quotas or some specific targets. And it hasn't changed a bit over the 50 years. And California has been always a little bit more liberal than the rest of the country. And so indeed in California, when that Proposition 20-whatever was first passed, it got 55% of the vote, not two thirds, but 55% of the vote. And the vote against it was exactly the same, 55%. So basically, there is no change. This idea that there's just a lot of change going out there, a lot of fervent and so forth, there's a lot of stability out there. There's just a lot of stability on this issue and on others as well.
I think it just speaks to the mismatch between policy positions that individuals take and their vote for a Trump or a Biden. And so, you know, there is just incredible diversity in what any one individual has in terms of their views. And, you know, yes, it's true that as new issues come into public dialogue, that people are more likely to kind of follow the views of their, you know, party elites. But it's limited. It's limited by people's self-interest. It's limited by, you know, their communities. It's limited by their own experiences. And so, you know, I think it's important to always remember that that a vote for Biden is not necessarily a vote for the Democratic platform. And just as a vote for Trump was not necessarily an endorsement of every single policy position that he advocated for. And you know, there's variation in the issues that people care about and their position on issues. You know, gun control is another one that we could throw out that in 2018, right, was a lot more of a focal point. And again, there's this huge disconnect between, you know, the party positions and where people stand in terms of their issue positions.
Terry, did you have a point on this?
No, I agree with, you know, what's been said here. I mean, I think it is true that affirmative action is not popular, and people vote against it when they have a chance to. That has been one of the constants over the decades.
One question that's emerged from a number of audience members is about Trump's refusal to concede. So I do want to get some of your takes on this, what that's motivated by, what that means for American democracy more generally. Maybe I could start with Ross on this question.
I mean, one, it's bad, right? You know, I guess I'll take Terry's brief for a minute and say, you know, it clearly, I mean, I think I'm a little more relaxed about some elements of Trumpian authoritarianism, and I don't think this is a coup in any kind of classic sense, but something can be not a coup and still be really bad, right? It has a sort of, you know, it's like a slow degradation of important democratic norms, and more practically, you know, it slows down the transition at a moment when there's a pandemic raging, when, you know, we have, thank God, some vaccines on the way, but we need to figure out vaccine distribution to add to sort of the normal run of presidential duties. And it encourages, you know, a lot of conservatives more than I would have hoped to sort of live in a kind of fantasy world of paranoia and conspiracy theories. So all of that's bad. I think from Trump's point of view, it's I mean, he's done this with everything he's ever lost in his life. When he lost the Emmy for The Apprentice, he said the Emmys were rigged. When he lost Iowa to Ted Cruz, he said the Iowa caucuses were rigged. When he won in 2016, he didn't win the popular vote, so he said the election was rigged. So there's nothing remotely surprising about this. And I think, you know, that apart from it sort of reflecting, you know, there's part of him, I'm sure, that really would like to hold on to power, but a larger part of him, this is just the pattern of his life. When he loses, he wants to be able to walk away and say, I didn't really lose. And, you know, one tell among many is that if you donate money to his campaign to fight, you know, voter fraud, a lot of that money is going to whatever he's going to set up post-election. So I think this is partially him preparing the way for, I'm sure he doesn't know exactly what it will be, but his sort of role as a figure who can claim to have been, you know, stabbed in the back by corrupt elites, and to use that to maintain his power and influence in the Republican Party going forward.
Paul, so I agree with all of that completely, Ross, but I wanted to place it in historical perspective because people have forgotten that Richard Nixon did not challenge the 1960 election when he lost in two states, Texas and Illinois, by fairly close margins. I don't know if it was as close as Trump's loss in Pennsylvania and Nevada, but it wasn't a wide margin at all. And he chose not to challenge the election, thinking it would be bad for democracy, despite the fact that Lyndon Johnson had a reputation of stealing elections down there in Texas, to say nothing of Mayor Daley in Chicago, who was the past master of voting the dead. So he did not do that. But norms changed in 2000 when Al Gore, you know, spared no expense to try to overturn that election. Now, admittedly, it was a very close election.
Very close.
It would have taken a lot of forbearance for the loser in that election not to have tried to do everything possible to turn that vote around in Florida. But it did change the norms. So after that, it now becomes sort of more permissible for political fights to go on after election day.
Terry, does this set a precedent, or is this still just going to be distinctive to Trump?
Look, I think you have two things going on at the same time. You know, I think there's normal politics, the norms of our democracy that are still adhered to, as far as I'm concerned, by people on the Democratic side. You know, Joe Biden is going to bring back normalcy to the presidency while he's in it, you know. But I think that with all due respect to people here and elsewhere, that the Republicans have abandoned those norms. They have trampled on them. They have thrown forbearance overboard and pushed their formal powers to the limits. Without any shame at all, they just do this. And our system can't withstand that, right? We need to have norms if the system is going to work properly. And all of this is also underpinned by polarization, right? Because it becomes a tribal thing. And if your tribe does it, it's okay. So you're going to have Republicans basically backing up these kinds of strategies. And, you know, I don't think that, first of all, I don't think that the Gore-Bush thing set a precedent. That was a very unique situation with one state, 500 votes. Of course, they're going to dispute that. But if you look at the concessions of losing candidates from that point on, 2004, 2008, right through to Hillary Clinton, they all just conceded, you know, when they lost. That's what people do when they allow the transition to go forward. It's Trump who is the departure from the norm, and that's because he is an authoritarian wannabe who's playing to his populist base. I agree with what Ross said about all the rationales that he may have for not conceding and for dragging this thing out. But it's very harmful to the nation, and all the Republicans in Congress are staying silent, right? True to form, they don't have the spine or the principle to stand up to this guy and to do what's right for the country. And this is just hugely important and negative in its consequences for America.
Okay. I'm given some comfort by the fact that I recognize that the vast majority of Americans don't care that much about politics, right? So that for, yes, there are some, you know, Trump supporters that are still riled up, but there's a whole bunch of Trump voters. They cast their ballot, and you know, I'm from Arkansas, so my Facebook feed is full of them, and they're back to posting puppy pictures, right? Like they've moved on, and they've moved on recognizing that Biden has won the election. And so I just that it actually gives me some comfort, the fact that, you know, I think that the elevation we saw in turnout this election cycle was not necessarily all a good thing, right? That part of what was going on was this fear about the direction of the country. And I would take some comfort in thinking that we can just go back to living our lives and not fretting for the health of democracy, you know, in the coming 4 years.
So sunshine in you all. I'm sorry that I'm happy you had that comforting message, because I have to go teach my class now.
Great. I think with that, we actually will sign up. Paul, thank you. I want to thank all of our panelists for this really fascinating discussion. I really enjoyed it, learned a lot. Sunshine Hillegas, Terry Ngo, Ross Douthat, and Paul Peterson. I hope all of you in the audience will join us for our future Center on U.S. Politics events. We have one coming up in about a month and another around the U.S. inauguration in January. So with that, thank you again to our panelists. Really, really appreciate it. It's a great discussion. And I hope all of you have a good evening.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, everyone.